All right, I think we're going to get started. So, welcome to the Playhouse, ladies and gentlemen. Pleasure to have you all here. Up now, we have the amazing Safraz Manzoor, broadcaster and author of the memoir Greetings from Berry Park, which is available online. We're really, really happy to have Safraz with us today. So would you please join me in welcoming Safraz Manzoor.
Hello, good afternoon. Gosh, apparently there's people waiting outside to try and get in. So it'll be one in, one out, I think, in a couple of minutes. So I decided to call this Confessions of a Bad Muslim, which was my idea, but I'm now thinking, I'm wondering whether you are expecting to watch some dodgy 70s softcore flick now, but maybe that's why you're all here. What I'm going to do is I'm going to talk to you for about 40 minutes or so, and then I'll throw it open to some questions. And assuming this PowerPoint works, there'll be some pictures you can look at along the way as well. It's going to be hopefully a bit serious, but hopefully a few jokes along the way. So I don't know how earnest a Greenbelt crowd is, but some of the things I'm saying, don't take them completely at face value as well. Now, as most of you know, I don't normally do this. I'm mostly a writer, and I normally prefer kind of being out there and commenting on other people rather than being on stage. But the reason I'm here is because I wanted to make a confession. And I wanted to make it in a public format. I wanted to make a public confession. And the confession is that I am a bad Muslim. Now, you might be wondering, what do you mean by a bad Muslim? And I think there's basically two varieties, I'd say, of bad Muslims. The first kind is somebody like this guy, who you've seen a lot of, sadly too much of in the last couple of days, Jihadi John, who beheaded the American journalist James Foley in Syria, part of Islamic State. And you know what these kind of crowd are like. And they've got their British version as well. Folks like this, you know, they're really into beards, they're into burqas, they're into bombs. You'd be pleased to know that's not the kind of bad Muslim that I'm talking about. And to try and explain what I mean by bad Muslim, I just want to tell you a little story. Just after 2011, just after 9/11, I was asked by the Guardian to go back to my hometown and talk to some kids back at my sixth form college. And the idea was that they wanted to try and find out what was going on inside the minds of young British Muslims. And so they sent me out there. And to be honest, I was kind of flattered to be asked because it felt like there was going to be a bit of me was flattered because I thought comprehensive, educated, working class kids going to go back to my sixth form college. You know, now I'm going to be this big shot journalist. They're going to think of me as like some kind of returning hero, maybe even a role model if I'm lucky. You know, maybe there might be a couple of photographs of me draped around somebody's arm or something like that. So I was talking to these to this crowd, and towards the end, I'm talking to this girl, and she's like, I think she's Bangladeshi. Her parents are from Bangladesh, and she's 17 years old. And I ask her a couple of questions, and then at the end of it, she says, "You know, you are amazing, aren't you?" I don't hear that enough from 17-year-old girls, so I took it in the spirit that I thought it was given. I said, well, I don't know if amazing is the right word, but, you know. She said, no, it's amazing for you to have come from where you've come from and to be such a sellout. It's amazing. And I realized that in her mind, I wasn't some kind of conquering hero. I was a bad Muslim because in her mind, because I didn't speak in a sort of faux patois and because I worked in the mainstream media, in some ways she thought of me as a coconut, somebody who was brown on the outside but white on the inside. And whenever I appear in the media, in newspapers or TV, I do get criticized, and it's pretty much always from other Muslims. And the reason is because they don't think that I'm conforming to a certain checklist of what they think Muslims should be like. And so, you know, for a lot of people, to be a good Muslim is to love Allah, but to hate America and to loathe Jews, to marry another Muslim, ideally somebody who is already in your direct family, to stay inside your community and not to ask any difficult questions. And according to that list, I am a bad Muslim. Now, you might be wondering, If you're going to make a confession, why make it in front of a bunch of strangers? You normally make this in front of your lover or your friends or your family or your priest. Why make it in a room like this? And to try and explain that, there's an old joke. There's a 92-year-old guy who goes to confession, and he sits down, and before he's even sat down, he blurts out, "Father, I've just had sex with two 19-year-old girls." And the priest says, "Don't recognize your voice. Are you part of this parish?" And the guy says, "No, I'm not." And he goes, "Well, are you a Catholic?" And the old man says, "No, I'm not." And the priest says, "Well, why are you telling me?" And the old man says, "Hell, I'm telling everyone." And I'm a bit like that, as in, I'm actually rather proud of my supposed sin. And not only do I feel secretly pleased about it, I actually think we could do with a few more bad Muslims in this country. And I think more bad Muslims would actually be rather good for society. So the question I'm going to try and answer in this hour is, how and why did I turn into a bad Muslim? Why didn't I turn up as angry and as alienated as those guys? Because the weird thing is, looking at me, I look quite different. I don't think they're wearing spotty trousers if you send the photograph down. But actually, I've got quite a lot in common with them, because I'm also from Pakistani background. I'm also from a working class family. I even come from the same town as those people, because I come from Luton. As an aside, Muslims do seem to have a bit of a habit from coming from absolutely godforsaken towns. Bradford, the West Country, Slough, and possibly worst of all, Luton. Now, that's the best the tourist office could do. Now, Luton was once voted the crappiest town in the country. This was a couple of years back. And I didn't find that so surprising. What I found really surprising was that it was voted this by the people who live there. When I was growing up, the person you most associated with Luton was, does anyone remember? Lorraine Chase, yeah. She did a television advert where she'd just come in from Luton Airport. And back then, Luton was kind of a bit cheesy. It was a bit naff. It was something that you made a bit of a joke about. And we people from Luton think of that as the good old days. Because now, when you say you come from Luton, the first thing people think of is a ticking time bomb. Because Luton is considered to be Al-Qaeda central. It's considered to be a hotbed of Islamic radicalism. And the reason for that is that the 7/7 bombers left from Luton train station on their way to blow up the London Underground. They went down from Yorkshire and they left from Luton train station on their way to blow up the London Underground. Now, I can see that that's a problem. What I don't understand is why Luton should be blamed for having good transport links to the capital. It isn't just the Muslims, though, from Luton. The EDL, you know the EDL? They also come from Luton. For those of you amongst the younger crowd who don't know about the EDL, they're like the BNP, but without the urbane sophistication. And their general thing is, we're not actually racist. We just don't like the extreme Islamists. We don't have a problem with most people. It's not about immigration. It's not about minorities. It's just the extreme Muslims we have a problem with. And I would love to believe them. I would love to believe them, but the problem is that the former head of the EDL, the founder, Tommy Robinson, works in the most racist job there is. He works in the one place where you're never going to see an Asian or a black person, because he's the manager of a tanning salon, which I think explains the EDL's official slogan that the future's bright, the future's orange. Now, this was the place I grew up, and to be honest, when I was growing up there, I did think, why was I cursed to come from Luton? And the answer is, it was all because of, oh, these are the EDL, sorry, and that's my dad, and that's really why I ended up in Luton. That's my dad, that's me, it's my younger sister, taken in the early 80s. Now, my dad, called Mohammed Banzor, and he was a good man, and he was a good Muslim. He was born in Pakistan in 1933, and he got married around about 1960. And when he had two kids, both of whom were under 2 years old, he realized that Somebody like him from a very humble background who wasn't born into privilege, who didn't know the right people in Pakistan, the only way he was actually going to have a good life was actually if he left Pakistan and he came to Britain. So he was a believer in the idea of progress, and he was a believer in the idea that you work hard to come somewhere else and you pay some sacrifices to come out somewhere else for your family. And so in 1963, he left my mum and my older brother and sister and came to Britain. And the story goes, apparently, that he basically had a piece of paper in his pocket of an address that he had some Pakistani people that he knew who lived somewhere near London. And that's all he had. And he got to the airport at Heathrow, and he got into a taxi, and he literally just gave this piece of paper to the taxi driver who took him to this house. And there he was ended up with these guys who were also from Pakistan, who'd also made a similar journey. And the idea was that he was going to basically work there in Britain, and he was going to send the money back, and eventually a day was going to come when he was going to be able to bring my mom and the rest of us over. If you're wondering how that works, that if he left in 63, how I have come to be in the world, is because he did actually pay a visit in 1970, which turned out to be seminal for lots of, you know, in many ways. So my dad left Pakistan, and here's the thing about being an immigrant, is when you're an immigrant, you can choose anywhere in the world to go. So when I was growing up in Luton, I did think, how is it that of all the places in the world, he has chosen Luton? Because when I grew up, I was thinking, why didn't you move to New York? You know, I could have grown up and seen the Statue of Liberty outside my house. I could have seen the Empire State Building. We didn't have such things in Luton. We had the Arndale Centre. And I didn't even get the Arndale Centre because I grew up in a place called Berry Park in Luton. And that was like the overwhelmingly Asian part of town. All my friends were Muslim, and pretty much everybody in my school was Muslim. Everyone who visited was Muslim. I was inside an absolute Muslim bubble, to the point that I didn't even really know what being a Muslim was, because it was all I was. I didn't have anyone else to kind of interact with, to kind of give me a kind of contrast about that. I'm just going to read you a little extract from my memoir called Greetings from Berry Park, which you should feel free to buy. I cried the first time that I was a Muslim. It was Christmas 1977, and I was 6 years old. By the 1970s, Berry Park in Luton was already overwhelmingly Pakistani, and the halal butchers, sari centres and carpet stores didn't bother shutting down for Christmas. When men like my father went to buy their bags of chapati flour and cans of ghee, it wasn't the plight of Mr. James Callaghan that they discussed, but the military coup in Pakistan, which had brought General Zia to power. On Eid, my father would buy live chickens from the local farm and sacrifice them in the backyard, throwing their heads into the fireplace as my mum started plucking them. My dad didn't work on Eid, but Christmas was an opportunity for him to work double time while the white people ate turkey. While he was working, the rest of us remained bored at home. During one Christmas week, while the rest of the family were busy, my two-year-old sister and I were watching television, and that is when we first came to watch Jesus of Nazareth. As a six-year-old, I didn't appreciate the religious significance of the series, because to me, Jesus was just another superhero, like Spider-Man or Steve Austin or the Incredible Hulk. I didn't know much about religion, but what I did know was the superheroes did not die. And that is why I burst into a flood of tears when at the end of Jesus of Nazareth, Robert Powell is hung from a cross, his face bleeding from a crown of thorns. I started crying, and my younger sister started crying. My mum comes rushing in. "Why are you crying?" she says. "They've killed Jesus," I explain, the tears streaming down my young face. "What do you say? Who's killed Jesus?" said my mum, drying my eyes with her debutter. "The Romans," I said, pointing to the screen. "It's just been on television." She looked me in the eyes and said, "That's why you're crying? Son, we're Muslims. It's Christians who cry about Jesus." This made absolutely no sense to me at all. An innocent man had just been crucified, and my mum was telling me I wasn't allowed to be upset. I started crying even harder. I wanted to be able to feel sorry for Jesus, and I wasn't sure I wanted to be a Muslim. So that was my life as a young kid, a boy in a Muslim bubble, not knowing any better. And then something really amazing happened, which is that we moved. We didn't move from Luton because I didn't have that kind of good luck, but we moved from Bury Park to another part of town. Now, it was called Marsh Farm. It was actually even rougher than Bury Park. There were riots there whilst I lived there. But the key thing is that it was very white. And that meant that everyone in my class suddenly was all English and white. And I had to deal with what it meant to live and hang out and be friends with white people. Now, this was the early 80s, and it wasn't actually easy being an Asian kid back then. My older sister went to high school, and the school insisted on a uniform of a skirt. And my dad did not want her to wear a skirt, and he wanted her to wear trousers. And he took her away from school for 3 months during this battle where the school insisted on a skirt, and he said, no, you've got to wear trousers. I mean, if you think about what kind of a different world we're living in, that's the kind of battle that you have. And it wasn't actually all that easy in some ways for me. I had a friend called Richard, and his dad was a member of the National Front. And I didn't really know what being a member of the National Front was, except I knew that I wasn't ever invited to his house. And the weird thing is that through Facebook and the internet, I looked up Richard recently, and we were chatted and caught up with a little bit. And what he didn't tell me was something which I learned later, which is that Richard is now a member of the BNP. So I guess you have to blame the parents on that one. People didn't really know much about Islam back in the 80s. For me, religion was something that was private. It was something that you practiced at home. My mum taught me Arabic when I was 10 years old. I learned the Quran at home. I didn't go to mosque or anything like that. And so you had to kind of explain to your friends what it meant to be Muslim. Like, why was it that I wasn't going to an assembly? Why was I not eating meat that wasn't halal? What was Eid? Nowadays, I guess most of you know about the religious festival of Eid. Well, back in the day, I had to try and explain this by saying, well, it's a bit like Christmas. Eid is our Christmas. And that's the way you kind of explain it to your friends, isn't it? And that almost worked, except one Eid when I told them that, my friends. And then that evening, I'm eating my chicken biryani with my family, and there was a knock on the door, and 4 of my friends were there singing Once in Royal David City. I mean, that was kind of funny, but there were times when it was a bit rubbish being brown-skinned. And the worst thing, for example, was girls, because there was no way I was going to get a girlfriend. My parents wouldn't have allowed it, but there was also no chance that any girl was going to admit to liking anyone like me in that way, in that time. So it was... That's not funny. That was actually quite sad. It's a very inappropriate laugh. Or maybe a cruel one, I don't know. So it wasn't easy being Asian back then, but to be honest, even despite all that, I'm still actually really glad that I went to a predominantly white school. Because if I had stayed in Bury Park, the chances are I would probably never have discovered Blackadder. I would probably have never discovered the Young Ones, because the Asian kids weren't watching that stuff. So leaving Bury Park actually opened my mind. Now, fast forward a couple of years, and I'm asked to go to Bury Park and go back to my original school when I was at my infant school to open a special ward or something, like an extension thing. And I go there, and I'm asked to speak to an assembly, a bit like you, but maybe not quite so well behaved. And I'm supposed to say a few words, and I stare out into the assembly. It's about 400 or 500 kids. There isn't a single face that's not brown. And I'm like, this can't be good. There is no sense that you're getting an interaction with the outside world or anybody else. And I think that if you look at what's happening, for example, with Birmingham and the Trojan horse thing, or you're looking at Bradford, so much of this is about closed communities who kind of are trying to stay closed. When I was at sixth form for that thing after 9/11 that I was telling you about, one of the girls said to me, I'm really scared because I'm going to go to university this autumn and there's going to be white people there and I don't really know what they're like. And she was 17. I just think that's kind of scary. That's also, by the way, why I think faith schools are a bit dodgy. And it's also why I think Muslim faith schools are exceptionally dodgy. It's because I think that we need to be mixing and getting to know people who are different from each other. It's not just a matter of it being good for the individual. I think that's good for society as well. Now, at the time, I didn't really know what I wanted to do with my life. My dad worked in a factory in Vauxhall, and all his friends did similar jobs. And it didn't really seem possible that I was going to do anything that different. I remember watching L.A. Law. Do you remember watching L.A. Law? And I just couldn't even imagine being a lawyer. The only lawyer I could imagine being was like an immigration lawyer trying to stop some kid having his dad deported back to Bangladesh. And I was like, this is not very glamorous. I used to have fantasies about being a Hollywood star, but even in my fantasies, the Hollywood star would be wearing a mask so that nobody would know that he was Asian. So it just didn't seem it was possible to do anything that was interesting because there weren't really any role models. If you were brown-skinned, if you looked like me, there was nobody on television out there doing anything that was interesting or creative that made you think you could aspire to it. I say that there was one person. One person somehow had managed to have brown skin, but to be on primetime television and to be a star. So for people like him, for people like me, in fact, he became a complete role model and an example of how it was possible to be brown skinned and be a big star. And I mean, I think you guys called him Des O'Connor, but we called him by his original name, which was Dev Kumar. But apart from Dev, there weren't really any role models. And so it was almost looking like I was going to have to give up on all these kind of ideas and just be kind of like the obligatory good Muslim boy. And then I fell in with the wrong crowd. I started spending time with people who led me astray. Now, luckily, they weren't religious extremists. I was raised to believe that religion was personal, not political. My dad and his family didn't spend time talking about Israel and Palestine. They weren't that interested in that stuff. They sometimes talked about Pakistani politics. But the people who really led me astray weren't found in mosques. I only went to mosque on Eid. They were found in books and in television shows and in films and in records. I found them in libraries and cinemas and record stores. And they changed me because they opened my mind up to a new world of possibilities. So I'm just going to single out a couple of them. Now, I was about 16 when I first watched Annie Hall. And I knew pretty soon that Woody Allen was my kind of guy. And I became a big Woody fan. I liked him for a lot of reasons. He was, of course, incredibly funny and quotable. I don't want to achieve immortality through my work. I want to achieve it through not dying. I'm not afraid of death. I just don't want to be there when it happens. Sex between a man and a woman can be a beautiful thing, but it depends on which man and woman you're between. It's all good stuff. That was a lazy thing for me to do, to just steal somebody else's line there, but it was funny. But I was really fascinated by his faith because he was quintessentially Jewish, but at the same time, he joked and played around with his religion. And I knew that I wanted to be a Muslim in the same way that Woody Allen was Jewish. The rest of my family didn't really get my Woody Allen obsession. He didn't look like what leading men are meant to look like. I'd been raised on Indian films, and their heroes looked like proper heroes. And here was this skinny guy with glasses who looked like a maths teacher. Now, incidentally, Woody Allen was also the reason why I never got into the whole hating Jews thing. Even though Muslims and Jews and Christians are all people of the book and have got loads in common, there is this sort of idea that Muslims aren't meant to get on with Jews. You may have read about that incident in Poplar in East London where young Muslims have put a black flag, which may or may not be the flag of ISIS, and they started demanding one of the guys who sort of wandered in was Jewish. And there was a sense that if he'd said yes, he wasn't going to get a prize. And then there was this image from a few days ago, which is either an illiterate anti-Semite or someone who's had enough of healthy living. He's so angry he can't spell. Now, I couldn't really get with that. For one thing, Jews and Muslims culturally have so much in common. I only learned recently, for example, that Muslims are even allowed to eat kosher meat. It doesn't work the other way, apparently. And I wrote a piece for The Guardian where I lived like a Jewish person for a month. And what most struck me about how similar it was, the pressures to marry within the faith, the desire to protect one's distinctive culture, the overbearing mum. It was all there. All that was different. It was a slightly different skullcap. Alongside those similarities was the fact that there is no way I could feel hostility to Jews, given how much that I love Woody Allen, Steven Spielberg, Bob Dylan, Philip Roth, and for slightly different reasons, Scarlett Johansson. It took me ages to find the right image of Scarlett Johansson, so I'm going to just keep it up there for a little bit. Now, I was lucky because my dad wasn't anti-Semitic, and so I never grew up with that kind of animosity towards Jewish people that some Muslims have. But it was slightly different when it came to Brits. My dad had come to Britain because he thought it offered a better life. He believed in the idea of Britain being a place of progress and promise. And yet at the same time, my dad was from a generation scarred by racism. He couldn't believe that it was truly possible for white people to be friends with Muslims. He used to say, white people, they'll work with you, they'll be educated with you, just don't ever think they'll be friends with you. And that's how I was raised, and that affected my sense of patriotism and my sense of belonging. I'm going to read a second extract from Greetings from Bury Park in the misguided hope it might tempt you to buy the book. So this is from 1982 now. I was the only boy in my school who wanted Argentina to win the World Cup and the Falklands War. It was early 1982. I was 11 years old and in my last year at junior school. In many ways, I wasn't any different from the other children in my class. I excused myself from school for Eid, but still handed out Christmas cards. At home, I read the Quran and learned Arabic. But at school, I talked about the young ones in the A-team. It was easy to believe that I was just like everyone else. My father, however, believed otherwise. My father left Pakistan when he was 29, but he never stopped being Pakistani. He came to Britain for economic reasons, and his relationship to his country and to this country remained rooted in financial pragmatism rather than emotional attachment. This is not your country, he would tell me. You've got your own country. You've got your own language. I was brought up to believe that Pakistan was our true home and Britain was just where we happened to live. When we lived in Bury Park, this was an easy distinction to make because we lived around Pakistanis. But when we moved to Marsh Farm, that all changed. Because then I became the schoolboy collecting Panini football stickers and stealing peeks of the girls doing handsprings in the playground in the hope of seeing a glimpse of their knickers. And then at home, my parents were telling me that I was Pakistani and I was different. When the first news flash came on television in the spring of 82 that Argentina had invaded the Falkland Islands, I didn't pay any attention. But within weeks, Mrs. Thatcher had dispatched the British Navy to the South Atlantic. In the evenings, my family would sit together and watch the television. Harrier jets were flying, the Union flag was flying. Everyone was gripped by patriotism. Even the kids in my school no longer played Manchester United against Tottenham, but the Argies against the Brits. Everyone hated the Argies, except my dad. Those thieving English bastards, he would mutter. So arrogant. Those islands, what have they got to do with England? They're thousands of miles away from this country. They're next to Argentina. Thatcher tells us they're hers. The arrogance of these people. My father cared little about Argentina. For him, the Falklands conflict was just another example of the British acting like they owned the world. Any incident, sporting or political, where the English were the losers, delighted him. Do you remember how excited they got when one of their boxers fought Ali? My father asked. Henry Cooper, that was his name, wasn't it? He was going to beat Muhammad Ali. By the time Ali had finished with him, their man Cooper was ready to convert to Islam. We all laughed at the silly Englishman who thought he could beat the Muslim. You know what the trouble with this country is, he'd say? It was built on theft. Have you heard of the Kui Nur diamond? One of the most beautiful diamonds and the biggest ones in history? It comes from Lahore, but it was stolen by Queen Victoria for her crown. That's what these people do. They take everything from other countries and claim it's theirs. For us, at home, the Falklands War was David and Goliath, and it was blindingly obvious that we should be supporting the Argentines. But not everyone in my school agreed. One afternoon, my teacher was showing us where the Falklands were on the map. After she'd pointed out, I put my hand up. Miss, you know how the Falklands are 8,000 miles away? Don't the Argentines have a right to say they belong to them? Mrs. Abbott was not impressed. The thing is, Safra, she said, slowly, as if I had learning difficulties, countries are not meant to invade other countries. That's wrong. That's why we're at war with Argentina. Mrs. Abbott wasn't really a geography teacher. She actually taught PE, and she would teach geography in tracksuit bottoms and top, and I suspected that she didn't know much more about the subject than I did. But Britain invaded countries all over the world, I said. How come that was right? Mrs. Abbott paused. This is geography, not history. If you want answers to that question... if you want answers to that question, talk to Mr. Morrison in your next lesson. We need to move on. Now, as I grew older, I started to question this reflexive anti-British attitude. The fact of the matter was that everything that I had achieved was in Britain. It was white British people who had employed me, who'd given me my opportunities. So it seemed kind of a bit ridiculous to have patriotism or loyalty to anywhere else. Now, I don't mean like blind patriotism, my country right or wrong. My kind of attitude to it is more like a house. If you've got a house and you don't like the furniture or you don't like the wallpaper, then you think, okay, I might get a new sofa or I might change the wallpaper. But you don't say, I think I'm going to blow the house up. The things that we can control and shape, the things that are in our choice, mattered more to me. Because choice has been a massive theme in my life. And I guess that's one of the reasons why I think I'm a bad Muslim, is because the choices I've made aren't the ones that I guess I was meant to make. Take money. I never got any pocket money when I was a kid. I normally get a bit more sympathy than that. So, I know we're in austere times, but for God's sake. Now, my parents would say, whenever I mentioned that, yes, white people do get pocket money, but then they have to pay rent as soon as they turn 18. And the correct thing you had to do was to work hard and give the money to your parents because they knew better. And so when I was 16 and I got my first sort of summer job, working in a sandwich factory, I'd work full-time, sometimes double-time, overtime, and then I'd get the money, and then Friday evening, I'd put it all on the table and give it to my dad. And, I mean, I kind of felt bad about it then. I felt even worse when I left Luton. I was in Manchester University and getting a summer job there and still giving the money, actually half of it, to my dad. It was a principled point that his thing was the money belongs to the family. It's not about the individual. I did it, but I have to confess that I felt bad about it because it didn't seem fair. Everyone with me so far? Okay. Has anyone left? It also didn't seem fair that you were meant to marry someone without having any say in it. That just seemed bonkers to me. I remember when I was a kid, I was about 17, and my dad started telling me about some girl back in the village who was 12. And he was saying, I think you should think about marrying her. Not now, but in a couple of years' time when you're ready, because by that point she'll be old enough, but you need to do it now because she's really pretty. And if you don't put your kind of deposit or your name down, somebody else will do it really quickly. So all I need is like just put a declaration of intent now. And then once you've finished your university stuff, then you can do it. He wasn't joking. That's actually how people thought like that. And I just remember coming back into my bedroom and I've got a diary entry from the time saying something like, why can't love be like Scott and Charlene in Neighbours? As in, which won't mean anything to you unless you're from that time, but it was just like, it seemed like such a simple idea, but it seemed like such a revolutionary idea that you should fall in love with somebody that you actually wanted to be with, marry somebody that wasn't going to, the idea of marriage wasn't going to scare the bejesus out of you, and it wasn't going to feel like, to quote the old joke, you know, marriage was not a word but a sentence. Those were the kinds of things that I was fighting. Now, in fairness, my brother and sister both had arranged marriages and they work, but I just felt like I was going on a different path. I'd started having these rebellious ideas from the culture I was kind of consuming and the books that I was reading and all that stuff. And then I encountered someone who completely changed my life, who basically, without whom I wouldn't be on this stage and I wouldn't have ended up doing anything that I've done in my life. And his name was Bruce Springsteen. And if you come away with nothing other than buying my book, the next thing you should do is buy a Springsteen album. Now, it's interesting that I got into him when I was 16, because that was round about the time. I'm not bored, I'm just trying to find out how much time I'm going. Okay, my gosh. I'm going to have to start speeding up if you want to ask any questions. I got into him round about the same time that I started drifting away from religion, which is kind of interesting. So I just at the point when I started giving up the whole fasting thing, I started listening more to Springsteen. And if religion is a code by which you live one's life, it's fair to say that Springsteen became my new religion. In his words, I found wisdom and insight and inspiration. I don't want to go on too much about it right now in the case that I might bore people for whom, you know, this is not really their bag. But if you want to read up about it, read the book or listen to the music, there's plenty out there. But I just want to highlight a couple of songs that I felt were absolutely critical in my life. The first was from a song called Thunder Road, which is on the Born to Run album. And the final line in Thunder Road is, It's a town full of losers, and I'm pulling out of here to win. It's a town full of losers, and I'm pulling out of here to win. Now, remember, I come from Luton. So for me, this really spoke, because I thought, this is a guy who gets my life. He kind of understands. And I felt like this music may actually have more than just escapism. It could actually have some wisdom and some insight about how to get out of the life that I had, to get out of that town of losers, and maybe pull out of here to win. So I started getting really into Springsteen. I listened to him. I started getting cuttings about him. I read books about him. I even started trying to dress like him. I had a bandana in my back pocket. I had a dog tag, which I stamped Born to Run on it. I also did something slightly, which I don't know if you'll be able to tell the difference, actually, but I'll give it a show you. So this is the cover of Tunnel of Love, 1987 album, Springsteen. Okay. Now, see if you can tell the difference between that. It's uncanny, isn't it? You're taking the piss. Now, Springsteen's music was revolutionary to me. Needless to say, my parents didn't get the appeal. But I felt that Bruce was confronting and answering every profound question that I had about my life. He has a line that he says on stage during the Born in the USA tour, which he used to say, "It's easy to let the best of yourself slip away." It's easy to let the best of yourself slip away. And I remember thinking that, you know, as a kid, where is my life possibly going to go if I follow the expectations that my culture or my family are telling me? And how is that different from the life that I really want? And there was a massive difference, because I would not have been the potential of the person I wanted to be, the best that I could be, would have slipped away if I had conformed too much to those things. And so that was part of the reason why, rather than just doing a boring factory job or doing a boring office job, I thought maybe it might be possible to do something creative where you actually enjoyed what you did rather than just thought of it as something for a job, you know, as for money. And even though I had absolutely no connections and I came from a comprehensive school background and I hadn't gone to Oxford and I didn't know anyone in the media, I started thinking maybe there is a place for somebody like me in that. And so I ended up getting some work experience at Granada Television and started to have a go at doing a bit of journalism. And it was just in those early days of getting into journalism that my dad suffered a serious heart attack. This was at the end of May 1995. And it's one of those kind of weird bridging moments, which are just sort of unspeakably sad. So I'm going to have to speak about it quite quickly, is that he died 3 days before I turned 24, in the same week that my very first article was ever published. So he never got to see the life that I was going, that I've subsequently had, and that is never going to stop hurting. The other thing that happened with my dad's death, which was a weird thing that I didn't expect, was that it turned out that I became less marriageable. I was told that the fact that I didn't have a dad made me in the calculus of arranged marriages, made me less of a good prospect. So in a weird way, that was actually good news for me, because it meant that a whole load of people who might have sort of knocked on my door no longer wanted to knock on my door. But it was also terrible, because it meant that I then had to start wondering about what the hell I was going to do about love. And this is where Springsteen came in again, because there's a line in Born to Run where he says, "Together, Wendy, we can live with the sadness, and I'll love you with all the madness in my soul. We'll live with the sadness, and I'll love you with all the madness in my soul." And I remember thinking to myself, that's a song, but it's almost like a marriage vow. You know, imagine loving someone so much that you're going to say to her, we'll live with the sadness and I'll love you with all the madness. And maybe it was just me, but I wasn't entirely convinced that I was going to get this in an arranged marriage. And as the years went on, my mum started gently suggesting that maybe I should settle down. When I say gently suggesting, she went on a hunger strike, but... But it was difficult, you know, because if you can't trust your mum to pick a shirt for you, do you really feel comfortable that she's going to pick a wife? I wrestled with this for a long time, and I knew that if I followed my heart, there was going to be a danger that I was going to lose my family. But the idea of marrying someone just to please someone else seemed to be everything against what I believed in. There's a song, this is the final line, Springsteen quote, is from Prove It All Night, where he sings, "Everybody's got a hunger they can't resist. There's so much that you want, you deserve much more than this. But if dreams came true, well, wouldn't that be nice? But this ain't no dream we're living through tonight. If you want it, you take it and you pay the price." So if dreams came true, wouldn't that be nice? But this ain't no dream we're living through tonight. If you want it, you take it and you pay the price. And I thought that was so profound, because what it was saying is that life is not a fairy tale. You're not going to get everything. It's just a matter of whether you're prepared to pay the price for the things you want, whether you're prepared to sacrifice for the things that you really believe in. And by this point, I thought, well, maybe I am. Maybe the things that matter are worth paying that price. I found out how high that price was in the summer of 2008 when I met a woman. She was sitting opposite me on a train coming back from Hereford. We started talking, and she was beautiful and she was interesting and she felt like she was the real deal. We ended up having a date, and I just thought, I think I may have just stumbled onto the person who I'm meant to be with. Her name was Bridget, and she was beautiful, as I said. She was clever, she was good-hearted. I'm saying all these things because I think she's in the room. And I couldn't ask for anything else. She was perfect in every way, except she wasn't Muslim. Now, by then, I was in my late 30s. I felt that I was able to be strong enough to take the abuse that I knew I would get from my family. And sure enough, when I told them about Bridget, they went completely ballistic. Because I had committed one of the worst of all sins. I'd fallen in love with a non-Muslim. I tried to tell them that she was a good person, but the only thing they cared about was the fact that she wasn't one of them. She said, my brother said to me, normal people do not do what you have done. And I said, who are normal people? And he said, people who live in Luton. It's a minority opinion, I think, maybe. It was incredibly painful being threatened with the prospect that my family would never talk to me. But I also knew that Bridget was the best thing that ever happened. So I asked her if she would agree to be my wife, and she said yes. So we set a date for August the 21st, 2010, and we told my family, and they said they were going to boycott the wedding. They weren't going to turn up because they just disagreed with everything that I was doing. But we stuck to our guns, and at the last minute, my sister and my mum did end up coming, but the older siblings stayed away. Despite that, though, it was still an incredibly joyful and happy day, and it was a day which I never thought was going to happen. And it was 4 years ago this weekend. You can see if you can spot my mum and my sister. After the wedding, things got much better with the family. It was almost as if they realised that once there was no changing my mind, they may as well resolve to the new reality. I'll be talking more about this, by the way, at 6 o'clock in a session called Mixed Blessing, which is all about the reality of mixed faith marriage. And if we're very lucky, my wife will join us, will join me. It just depends, because you know how it is. I've got to try and persuade her still. She's not entirely sure she's going to do it. She's on the billing, though. Now, 1 year later, my wife and I became parents for the first time. That was taken when my daughter was only about an hour old. Now, the really interesting thing about that, if you can see, is that the T-shirt I'm wearing says coexist, and it says it based on all the kind of religious symbols. And I thought that was really apt, and I really just loved that. And it just happened to be an accident that I happened to be wearing that. But I've worn this T-shirt everywhere. I've worn it in America. I've worn it in Israel. I've worn it in India. I basically wear it whenever I think I'm going to get the crap beaten out of me for being Muslim. I remember ringing my mum after my daughter was born, and the first thing she wanted to know was, is your daughter being raised a Muslim? That was like literally the first question she asked. She wasn't even interested in the weight or anything. And as I've explained, my family had given me quite a lot of grief beforehand, so I thought I'd wind them up. So I said, no, actually, we're not raising her. We're not actually going to raise her as a Muslim. And my mum was like, you're going to raise her as a Christian? I said, no. We've decided we're going to raise her Jewish. And once she came to, I explained that it made complete sense, because that way my daughter still gets to feel persecuted and I still get to hope that she marries a doctor. Needless to say, my daughter has helped things get much better, which I think shows the value of following your passions and your heart. And this is how she... She may turn up at the session as well. So that's the story where we are now. I look at my life now and it seems so different from where I started. It was 40 years ago this year that I arrived in this country. We lived in a tiny terraced house. My dad worked in a factory, and back then the horizon did not stretch very far. I could never have imagined that I would have the life that I have. Most of the time, to be honest, I hardly think about being Muslim. It's just part of the backdrop to who I am. But then something happens, like the brutal beheading of James Foley, and it will freshly astonish me that there are young guys from towns like mine, with backgrounds a bit like mine, who've turned into such cold-eyed monsters. And yeah, I do wonder how that's happened. I wonder what led to the road they've taken, and why others have gone down this murderous path. I don't claim to have any definitive answers, but I can offer a few thoughts. The first is that I don't really think this is about religion. Islam is cited, but many of these guys are converts. They buy books called Islam for Dummies to mug up on the pretext that they're using. My own hunch is that this is about wanting to belong. It's about being part of a group and wanting to be feared and respected. These guys would be football hooligans if they were white and living in the 80s. They would be a different kind of gang. What radical Islam has done is give them a reason to live and a reason to die. It's made them believe that they are bigger than just themselves. Everyone wants to belong. We can talk about brainwashing imams and the dangerous power of the internet, but at heart, I think this is about a double betrayal. These people were made in Britain, and something happened along the way that meant that they never grew up truly believing that this was their home. They weren't persuaded by the idea of Britain, and I think we have to look at who and what was responsible for that. I also think there is another betrayal, even sadder in some ways, and that is the betrayal of the first generation, people like my parents. I look at these guys and I wonder, I'm talking about the guys who are out there in Syria and the other ones, and I wonder, what do their parents and their grandparents think? The folks like my late father, who came in the 60s, battled true and hard racism to make things better for their children. And for them to be repaid like this, a generation seemingly rejecting that their parents worked hard, is a tragic betrayal. As for myself, all I can do is try and show that there is another way, that there are other roads that can be taken. And given the right inspirations, the right education, and the right opportunities, I confess that I still believe it's possible to be a very different kind of bad Muslim. Thank you. Okay, I don't know. I think we've got about 5-10 minutes. Okay, we've got a couple of minutes. If anyone wants to throw a question at me, I don't know if are there speakers or anything? Are there microphones or anything? I don't know. But if anyone's got a question they can ask, they can throw it up. Yeah, okay, go for it. Am I still a Muslim? Yeah, this is what I was having an argument with my wife about yesterday, actually. Well, I would say that I was cultural in the sense that this is something which I grew up with, but there are still aspects of that culture which I observe. So, for example, I don't drink. I still only eat meat that's halal. So those kind of things, I'm observant about. But I would say that I'm more into the idea of the culture, the fact that there is there are codes and ways of being which I support, rather than believing in some kind of very dogmatic way that there is only one way of being, that there is only one person who seems to hold all truth. I don't believe that particularly. So I would say more cultural, but not so cultural that I've given up and dispatched everything. Yeah. Well, the question was, what would people like my father's expectations have been for his grandchildren and great-grandchildren? It's such a difficult question, and I think the only way I can answer that is, it's only when you're faced with the reality of these things that your opinions sometimes, that they exist in some ways. And as a theoretical question, it doesn't work. I'll give you an example, which doesn't quite answer your question, but it sort of does, which is that when I told her first about the woman who's now my wife, my mum was absolutely hateful. She was just like, I don't want to meet her. I don't want to know her. She could go to Mecca 7 times in a row, but it wouldn't matter. She's never going to be welcome. Now, she absolutely loves her and tells me I should do everything she says. And And I don't like to try and bring it up very often, but the other, I mean, I did recently bring it up and I said, look, you know, how is it that you were so horrible about Bridget back then and now you love her? And she said, well, see, that's when I thought she was English, but she's Scottish. Yeah. Yeah. Which is kind of what I was talking about my dad being kind of pragmatic, as in actually, if he stayed in Pakistan. Just a very quick thing, I was in Pakistan a couple of years ago to do a documentary for Radio 4, and I was in this very fancy dinner party with some very posh Karachi folk, and they were very snooty about the Muslims, the Pakistanis who'd come to Britain. And he said, you know, they were all very low-class people, you know, the intellectuals stayed here. And I said, yeah, but if I'd stayed here, I'd be one of the waiters who's serving your bloody food. I wouldn't have been round the table. So there is a bit of that sort of aspect of things. Anyone else? Yeah, there's a guy there. Yeah, he's got it. Are you still applying for compensation or no? The question is there anything that the rest of us, I suppose he means white people, can do to integrate and bring out these communities more in Bradford? I think the answer to that very simply is it's about schools, isn't it? It's about education. It's about getting in there. The problem is if you've got schools that are de facto segregated because the communities are 95% drawn from one particular community and that community is all of a particular background, where are the kids getting any kind of other interaction, you know? In Luton, which is where I come from, they have an exchange scheme, school exchange system, with other schools in Luton. They've got like 10 schools which are very Asian, writing letters and giving gifts and keeping in touch with other 10 schools that are also in Luton. That's true. Huh? It's kind of working. I went to see it. I mean, to be honest, I feel it was very interesting. I saw it before I had a kid, and now I feel a bit guilty about what I did, because I was there, and there were these people, and they were like, what they did was they got like an Asian person and a white person, and they got them to ask a question about what do you think is the same about you, what is the same different about you, and there were these like, you know, an Asian person and a white person, and they were saying, well, we're both the same because we like Arsenal, but we're different because we're wearing different coloured shoes. And I say, is there anything else that's different? Yeah, because she's wearing a shirt and I'm wearing a blazer. I'm like, yeah, is there anything else that's different? And like, they just didn't think that it was because they were, and like now I think that's like, I look at Layla, my daughter, and she doesn't see colour. And I think I was a bit guilty. I feel wrong for having tried to poke them in that way. But I didn't have a kid then, and I wouldn't do that the same way. So I think it is working, but it also shows you that kids don't actually see colour in the same way. Am I being told to round up? Okay, well, can I just say thank you so much for all you guys coming out. I really, really appreciate it. I hope you've enjoyed it. And if any of you are around at 6 o'clock, like I said, I'm doing this other mixed faith tour. The book's called Greetings from Bury Park, and you can follow me on Twitter. Thank you.